My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We hope you'll stay tuned. My name is Mike Thornton, doing a program with Eric Siljak today, which I guess, Eric, at some point we'll call what? Global Logic Full Kitchen or
Lunch Edition of
something or another. lunch edition of Public Affairs Pledge Drive programming on community radio. I know Eric and I both happened to be seeing Mr. Walter Rockler's name, and both of us were going to call him, and then we wound up doing this program together, and Walter Rockler is with us. Mr. Rockler, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
It is our pleasure to have you on, sir. Walter Rockler is joining us because Eric Siljak and I both saw a release from the Institute for Public Accuracy, which included a statement from Walter Rockler regarding current issues around indictments for war crimes and war criminals. Walter Rockler should know what he's talking about when it comes to the issue of war crimes and war crimes trials. Walter Rockler was one of the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. And once again, Mr. Rockler, thank you for being with us. Can we begin, sir, by perhaps talking a little bit about the Nuremberg trials and then using that to compare what is happening today?
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you, sir. Please go ahead.
Well, at Nuremberg, the United States and Britain basically rested their prosecution upon the crime of waging aggressive war, planning, preparing, and launching an aggressive war. In other words, the acts of the Germans in attacking Poland, Denmark, any number of countries, including at that time Yugoslavia as well, which was defending itself. And the court, which represented the four powers in control of Germany after the war, declared that the ultimate crime in war is the crime of launching and planning and preparing an aggressive war. Some of us took that seriously. Certainly the United States and British prosecutors took it seriously. War crimes and crimes against humanity were charged against many of the defendants as well, but from the American and British standpoint at that time, aggression was the principal charge. And the court declared that this is the ultimate crime because it contains within itself all the other crimes of war. Now, the Nuremberg court determined as well that there were monumental crimes against humanity in extermination programs and slave labor programs and general abuse and mistreatment of the populations of occupied countries. But those were, to a certain extent, almost secondary charges at Nuremberg.
We're talking with Walter Rockler, who is joining us to talk about war crimes, war criminals, and war crimes trials. Mr. Rockler was one of the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. Mr. Rockler, let me ask you, as I understand it, you spent some 2 years prosecuting crimes committed by Nazi, primarily industrialists and bankers, correct?
Very heavily bankers.
Can you talk about your 2 years at Nuremberg and talk about the role that bankers and or industrialists played in
last trial at Nuremberg, which was the trial in which I participated, we had several different counts. There were cases brought against industrialists, in particular the Krupp organization, IG Farben, and the Flick enterprises, which were iron and steel and war industries. But the banking case was my personal province. Originally it had been projected as a case against the two largest German banks, and as the trials went on, it was decided to curtail the docket for a number of considerations, not least of which was the developing Cold War at that time. So we finally shook that down to a case against the Dresdner Bank. And the charges against the Dresdner Bank were traditional war crimes and crimes against humanity, really. The Dresdner Bank served as a bird dog for the German Ministry of Economics in locating properties the Germans would grab, mostly in the occupied territories, Czechoslovakia, France, Belgium, Holland, and to a lesser degree some properties in the Baltic countries. These were heavily Jewish properties whose owners could anticipate, in most cases they were right, being murdered by the Nazis, and the Dresdner Bank wasn't much concerned with that. They were concerned to get the properties in the hands of their customers, which they did. In some cases, they wanted legalities observed, and they would bring in the Gestapo for conference purposes so they could get the defendants, the opposite side to the negotiations, agreeable to signing documents. Those were the heaviest charges against the Dresdner Bank. I also prosecuted a vice president of the Reichsbank, which was the central bank of issue for Germany, comparable to the Federal Reserve System or the Bank of England. The Reichsbank was a storage vault for, incredibly, gold teeth, gold wedding rings, gold fountain pens, gold wristwatches, anything with gold in it that had been taken from the corpses of people in concentration camps. The vice president of the Reichsbank that I prosecuted was convicted for handling these properties and turning them into currency, I guess. I also was involved in a case against an undersecretary of the Ministry of Economics who oversaw these splendid programs of the Nazis.
What most people don't realize, what I didn't realize until I started doing some research for this program, is there were some 12 trials held at Nuremberg, something like that, weren't there?
Yes. There was the original trial, which is the most famous and the most important, and I was not a part of that. That was run by Supreme Court Justice Jackson for the American side of the case. And it pronounced the most important law, pronounced the law that I referred to earlier. But the other 12 trials were particularly interesting, first because they amplified some of the decisions of the basic Nuremberg court, and because they covered a wide range of affiliates of the Nazi system, industrialists, bankers, steel concerns of various sorts, doctors, lawyers, judges. In other words, the entire fabric of Nazi society, and more than the fabric, these were the institutional supports of the system. These people lent themselves to the Nazi activities.
And the point being, of course, that no military can really prosecute a war, the type of war that you were involved in prosecuting criminals from, without the support of the structure of a given society, correct?
Well, that was my view at the time. I had some option in what kind of case I wanted to work on, and I elected and was allowed to proceed with what I regarded as the institutional basis for the Nazi system. These people who lent themselves to it, many of whom knew better.
We're talking with Walter Rockler, who is joining us to talk about war crimes, war criminals, and war crime trials. Walter Rockler was one of the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials of the Nazis at the end of World War II. Eric.
And Mr. Rockler, I would like now to draw some parallels between this present case, because we have this International Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and I understand that this present tribunal actually was modeled on Nuremberg trials. And how would the Nuremberg court judge the U.S. war against Yugoslavia today?
Well, I think the Nuremberg court, assuming that it would remain consistent, would hold that this is a war of aggression launched by the United States. But the Yugoslav war crimes court is not a perfect parallel to Nuremberg by any means.
Why would that be?
Because of the way the court is set up and because of some of its special attributes.
Yeah, and one of these attributes...
One of the attributes, for example, is that it's the court that indicts people. At Nuremberg, the prosecution and the court were basically separate. The court tried people, which is in the American tradition, but it certainly didn't decide who should be brought before it.
I see.
Whereas in the Yugoslav case, I regard this as one of the defects in the procedures. The prosecutors recommend to the court that the court ratify an indictment of particular people before those people are brought before the court, which I think to some extent damages a presumption of innocence.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program.
Well, this international tribunal has lost a lot of its credibility by indicting this a few days ago Milosevic and four of his associates, but refusing to even consider indicting much more serious crimes and destruction committed by leaders of NATO. Because during the 2 months of bombing, more civilians died than in previous 2 years of conflict. We know by now that.
Well, I think there's something to that. I don't disagree with you.
Would it be fair to say that this there is at least apparent that this tribunal is serving as a public relation arm of the United States and Great Britain?
No, I don't think that does justice to these people. I think they're all relatively sincere. They're moderately competent. They get perhaps highly competent. I don't know. I think the people involved are taken individually, probably sincere enough in what they're doing. The activity itself seems to be directed by the NATO countries. The appointments are primarily of NATO citizens and appropriate NATO citizens who are relatively agreeable. They're not going to attack the hands that feed them, that's all.
Well, this is kind of a blunt question, but are we romanticizing this Nuremberg trial? Or was it different? Was it a fair trial, or was it like this present one, just a political manipulation under the facade of justice?
Well, if I were charged with criminal behavior, I would not mind being tried by the Nuremberg Tribunal. I don't think any of the Germans, with the exception of fanatic Nazis, ever charged that the trials were unfair, because we had a totally different kind of evidence. The Germans kept meticulous records, and they kept them intact at the end of the war, and we got those records. Records of conferences of high leaders, of industrialists, whatever. Also, we had complete control of the country. We had occupied the country from one end to the other at the end of the war. We could secure any person who lived in Germany, either as a defendant or as a witness. These conditions don't exist in Yugoslavia.
We're talking with Walter Rockler about war crimes, war criminals, and war crimes trials. Mr. Rockler is one of the prosecutors who took part in history at the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II.
Now, our president, Rockler, he was trying and has been trying all these last 2 months very hard to build a moral case for this warfare against Yugoslavia by focusing on atrocities and really demonizing, Milosevic and all the other people there. So Miss Arbour, Louise Arbour, at the tribunal, she is obliged to take evidence from all sides. She has refused to take evidence against NATO leaders as a step towards indictment. What's the legal base for that?
There isn't a legal base for it. The prosecutors decide what cases they're going to bring, and I would have wagered large amounts of money that she would refuse. What does she owe her appointment to? Who are the countries that designated her? Who created this tribunal? I don't recall that there was any Yugoslav input into it, whatever. As to the moral case the president is creating, I think it has feet of clay all the way. when the Croatians drove out 200 or 300,000 Serbs from the Krajina area of Croatia, who had lived there for hundreds of years, I don't recall the NATO countries ever said they have to be restored to their homes. That was okay. Depends on who does what to whom. When in Africa hundreds of thousands of people were being slaughtered, we didn't take any action whatever. In Central America, we've probably been supporting and espousing causes and activities which have resulted in the death of a couple hundred thousand, basically Indians in those countries. As a matter of fact, the president recently apologized for the American role in that killing. So these alleged humanitarian concerns do not grab me quite in the same way as they do the president, as a basis for bombing the population at large. I will say that I do object to the treatment of the Albanians and driving them out of their homes and driving them to the borders. I'm not sure the solution to that activity is bombing the Serb population.
We're talking with Walter Rockler, who's joining us to talk about war crimes, war criminals, and war crimes trials. Mr. Rockler, let me ask you, because when you're speaking, I'm thinking about the situation in Iraq, where now hundreds of thousands of people have died, primarily as a result of U.S.-driven and U.S.-enforced sanctions. I mean, when people start throwing the terms of the war criminals and war crimes about, I mean, it seems to me that the U.S. is really open for being charged with the same types, if not worse, war crimes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I have already taken that view. That is where I arrived at some weeks ago when this bombing campaign started. I see no justification for turning our rather advanced and numerous bombers loose on Yugoslavia, and I regard it as a war crime. I regard it as the crime of aggression as the Nuremberg Tribunal found it to be. I don't think there's any justification for it. As far as I know, there's nothing defensive about it. The Yugoslavs attacked no foreign country whatever at any point.
So when
I think the Iraq case is a little bit different. I'm not in favor of bombing Iraq freely and promiscuously either. I think it's a bad tactic. But the Iraqis did attack a foreign country. And the Iraqis have done a few things that I do not like at all. They have used poison gas, which I regard as absolutely outlawed, against both Iranians and Kurds. And I don't think there's any justification for that. They've fiddled around trying to develop bacteriological weapons. In other words, I think their conduct has been worse. And nevertheless, I don't favor unlimited bombing of Iraq from day to day either.
One of the things, and I just wanted to explore a little bit further, and that is when we're talking about war crimes, I mean, I think any number of people in the public, you know, throw out terms war crimes, war criminal, and all of that. They do that mostly from an emotional or moral standpoint. I mean, when you're talking about war crimes, you're talking about war crimes maybe from an emotional and moral point as well, but also from a legal point, correct?
Yes, very heavily so. I have a strong objection to war crimes personally.
Sure.
I spent 2 years prosecuting war crimes and crimes against humanity. But the one thing which I keep in mind is it's war that gives rise to war crimes, and to launch a war is not my idea of how to solve the problem.
Now, it's under the Nuremberg law principles, it is a punishable war crime to engage in destruction of cities, towns, and villages, or devastation that's not justified by military necessity. But now we have this humanitarian intervention where we have direct attacks by United States airplanes on civilians in violation of international law. But apparently this have become acceptable and consistent with this new humanitarian ethics. Now we say maybe that's illegal, maybe it's not according to the law, maybe it's breaking the sovereignty of the state, but we do have this moral. I mean, Clinton was not quoting any body of international law, even UN Charter. He was saying it is moral imperative to wage the war against Yugoslavia. So I want to ask you about this moral environment which permits really the United States to kill civilians without constraint.
Well, I don't think there's anything particularly moral about killing civilians without restraint, and I don't think Mr. Clinton's moral campaign has any base. Regrettably, the Nuremberg court did not pass on bombing, the reason being that everybody did it, and we did it on an even bigger scale, finally, than the Germans. So they glossed over that whole thing. But the Hague Conventions and the Geneva Conventions after the war have made it clear when you get to things like bombing, the only permissible objectives, assuming the war is legitimate in some way, are military objectives, and in a way which does not cause undue damage to the civilian population. Now, our bombing campaign initially was quite limited, but not so limited that it excluded bridges, waterworks, electric plants, sanitariums, trains, trucks, factories of any kind, so that the bombing campaign, everything else aside, in my view, has reached a point where it violates the laws of war, the very simple laws of war as to how you conduct a war.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. We're talking with Walter Rockler, who is joining us today to talk about war crimes, war criminals, and war crimes trials. Walter Rockler is a former prosecutor at the Nazi Nuremberg trials after World War II. You are tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. Mr. Rockler, let me ask you, some 2 years ago, I believe, or perhaps somewhere around in there, you participated in a forum, in a conference, I believe at the University of Connecticut, something I don't know the exact title, but having to do with 50 years after Nuremberg. And you made a real interesting statement that I read about international law. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the statement was quite consistent with what I'm saying now. I remember appearing at the University of Connecticut, along with a handful of my surviving fellow prosecutors at Nuremberg, whom I know quite well at this point. I was a little bit out of step because I thought one of the failures of Nuremberg was to take a strong position on bombing and damage to civilian populations. The fact that we had done it, I didn't think necessarily constituted a justification for what might occur in the future. I have been concerned, of course, Nuremberg was a trial of Germans and did not involve the use of nuclear weapons. But the fact that nobody is dealing with the nuclear threat, and in fact it may be reconstituted as we develop a new Cold War with respect to the Chinese, gives me some pause. We have all the nuclear weapons in the world to speak of. But 8 or 10 other countries have developed their own nuclear weapons, and nobody is doing anything about it whatever. In other words, we are sitting tight with our 8,000 nuclear missiles, the Russians have their 6,000. The rest of the world is starting to pile them up, with additional countries looking to their nuclear weapons. This doesn't seem to me a wholesome world in the future, and it seems to me the time to deal with it is now. Those were two positions I stated, I think, at Connecticut.
From what I read, I think that pretty well summed up what I had gleaned from the material that I saw that came from it. You seemed very, very, in that statement that I read, very, very pessimistic about the whole issue of whether international law could be used, or at least to deal with these types of problems, or maybe I misread it.
No, I think international law could be developed and used to deal with these things, but one of the things that has to happen is at least our own country ought to have to observe international law and not disregard it as a matter of inconvenience. And I think it has to be strengthened. I mean, we live in a world today which still has almost all the attributes of anarchy, in which any state can do anything it pleases, and we've kind of encouraged that view with our recent conduct.
Well, now
we've violated every treaty in sight.
Well, to come back to that recent war, actually still ongoing, even if they talk about some peace initiatives, there are still bombing going on as we speak.
That's what's known as getting in the last licks. I mean, you want to make sense of it? Go ahead. I can't.
Right. Neither can we.
Yeah. We were just trying to, I mean, one of the things that was said, even in this peace process in Rambouillet, everybody agreed that province of Kosovo is legally and, coming under the sovereignty of Yugoslavia, that is part of Yugoslavia, nobody questioned. There was
the original heartland.
Right. And there was this ongoing, this last year at least, a guerrilla war with the Kosovo Liberation Army, so-called fighters for secession from Yugoslavia. So one of the basic accusations in these peace talks in Paris, and one of the reasons that we have been hearing that NATO has to intervene, is that Milosevic, even if he had some legitimate right to fight the secession and all these terrorists on his territory, but he's been using disproportionate force to repress this Kosovo Liberation Army. Well, now our president is using disproportionate and indiscriminate force to suppress Milosevic. So now the same principle of this disproportionate force is being used by both Clinton and Milosevic, seems to me.
You can't get an argument from me. but I remember years and years and years ago, maybe before the memory of mankind, when a handful of Puerto Rican nationalists appeared in the House of Representatives and started shooting the place up.
Mm-hmm.
These people were not sponsored by anybody in the American government. They wound up with long prison sentences. it's not unusual for most governments to resist insurrections. But the arrogance of our position is, to me, appalling. In other words, we set down a bunch of conditions as to how Kosovo should run, and then declare that they're non-negotiable. It's the non-negotiability which I find almost preposterous. I mean, how do you do that kind of thing, except if you think you're running the world and what you say goes? In other words, when I say jump, you jump. When I say lie down, you lie down. That's all there's to it.
And you are, Mr. Rockler, you're a lawyer also. So let me ask you just one brief thing.
I'm a lawyer primarily.
Right. Right. And that we've been now talking about this disproportionate force. There is another term that's been used very often during this war, and actually throughout the 90s, this so-called level playing field. During the war in Bosnia, I'm sure our listeners will remember, the big argument for bombing the Serbs then was that there is no level playing field and that they have too much power vis-a-vis the enemy. Well, now actually we are seeing that, you know, a country has been attacked with really no means to defend itself. Yugoslavia against the NATO 19 most powerful countries. So now I don't hear about this level playing field anymore. What is this level playing field at all?
Well, I don't think there ever has been a level playing field in international politics. I am somewhat schizophrenic about a certain aspect of this bombing campaign. I am glad that no Americans have been killed. At the same time, it seems to me somewhat cowardly to take the latest weapons 30,000 feet up and just drop bombs at random from time to time. I can't reconcile those two positions.
We're talking with...
I happen to be an American citizen.
We're talking with Walter Rockler, who's a lawyer, primarily, and also former prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II. We're talking about war crimes, war criminals, international law, and war crimes trials. Eric?
Well, I would like to say, because you mentioned that every possible international law was broken in this attack on Yugoslavia, does it then mean that the rules of war don't apply to big powers? Or, in other words, if the villain is large enough, then the very notion of criminality disappears altogether?
Regrettably, I think there is something to that. You cannot chastise a big power except by defeating it in war. And that's a terrible remedy in its own way. You can look to the population of that power to control its government, hopefully, but that's a slow-moving process. That really happened in the Vietnam War. Ultimately, it was so clear that the American public wouldn't stand for it anymore that it had to be discontinued without success. But in this war, first, it hasn't been televised like the Vietnam War was. The military has learned that the American public does not like what it sees in war. And second, there haven't been any American casualties, for which I am duly grateful, I can say. And therefore, the impact on the public hasn't been that great. I've not said not only that it violates treaties, but it violates also the United States Constitution. And nobody is looking for much of a remedy there. The president doesn't have the power to treat the military as his personal bodyguard to be sent anywhere he suits pleases. He can't order the American military establishment to attack any country he sees fit to attack. That's not what the Constitution provides. The power to declare war is the power of the Congress. If Congress abdicates, so much the worse for the Congress.
And looks like
the population, I think, has shifted its view of the war somewhat, probably not sufficiently to make all that much difference. But it's gone from an initial patriotic reaction of about two-thirds down to about a half. You've got people like ex-President Jimmy Carter attacking the war on perfectly good grounds and sensible grounds, and that has some impact. It was a courageous step on his part, in my opinion.
Certainly, I agree with you. One of the things that we've really been discussing a lot is why so many of the American people have seemed to be lethargic in their reaction to what has been happening regarding this latest war. Do you have any thoughts on that, Mr. Rockler?
Well, I think the population in general feels itself to be impotent in political matters, and certainly when a decisive and arrogant action is undertaken by the administration, the ordinary citizen on the street first listens to its leaders and absorbs what they have to say. After a while, it may learn that some of the leadership observations are not sound. They have no basis. They're exaggerated. The press in this respect has not been a great asset. By and large, they focused on human interest stories about refugees. In other words, which I think have some justification. I mean, I'm not in favor of pushing the Albanian population around either. But they have not focused on the basic questions here. And they don't intend to. They are sufficiently subservient in matters of foreign affairs, you know. Disagreement in the United States stops at the water's edge. And it takes an endless demonstration of what the war is all about, as occurred in the Vietnam case, before the population reacts sufficiently. The other factor is we have no draft. We're using our paid army and military for this purpose, which impacts a lot less on the population. Mr. Clinton didn't like the Vietnam War, but the question is, why didn't he like it? He seems to have liked every other war.
Well, he didn't like the one that I guess he would have had to go fight in, probably.
I sometimes think that might be the case.
Certainly, being the one who has to go out and possibly fight, bleed, and die probably puts military action in a different light. I'm sorry, sir, go ahead.
I say it's much less attractive when you're in that position.
Well, talking about this, how media was playing along with the State Department and the NATO officials and the Pentagon and was really promoting this war on every possible level. But disturbing thing is that what Mike here, my colleague, mentioned a minute ago, the general population looks like there is this cozy feeling because now we are assured that there will be no U.S. ground troops, there will be no U.S. casualties. This is like some video game and somebody's going to get killed, but it's not going to be us. Seems like the interest is really not there. And this moral thing is, I think, you know, we talk about ethnical cleansing in Yugoslavia, but somebody mentioned the phrase ethic cleansing that we are witnessing in this country.
Without American casualties, and I will repeat again that I'm glad there aren't any. There isn't much impact on the American population, which then reads its daily press and listens to its leaders explain that all of this is a great humanitarian venture. And not only that, believes it. Therefore, you don't get too quickly public outrage. I think there is probably some movement against this, against the activities that have been undertaken. My understanding is the last poll showed something like a 50-50 division of the population, which is kind of surprising, considering what they're subjected to. But it would take a long time to build up a popular resistance. If the costs of this war were emphasized more strongly, which they are not, I think the American population might be more resentful. It's my understanding that the limited costs so far are in the area of $13, $14 billion. This administration proudly proclaimed in the recent budget discussions that they were adding a billion to federal aid to education, very dear to the heart of the administration. A billion is not the equivalent of 14 billion, and before we're finished in Yugoslavia with this endless occupation of Kosovo, because I don't see how it comes to an end, we've established the NATO protectorate in Kosovo. I don't know what the costs will be, but they'll be astronomical in terms of zeros after some number.
And certainly all of this takes place at the same time that various social services and programs that were at one time in place to help assist people in this country are being dismantled.
But it's certainly going to eliminate the so-called budget surplus. It isn't going to improve the prospects for financial stability in the Medicare system. It isn't going to solve any of the problems of domestic United States. That seems clear.
That's certainly
true. I really regard that personally as secondary, but I think if it were emphasized, a lot of people who pay taxes might resent it.
Well, I think it would certainly get their attention.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with Walter Rockler, lawyer and former prosecutor at the Nazi Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II. Mr. Rockler, we're having to begin to work our way towards ending this program today. But what I'd like to ask you, sir, is that looking back at your involvement in Nuremberg and also just from simply leading a long life, and it's obvious that you're a very well-read and very bright man, and comparing all of that and trying to put that in some context with what's happening today, can you share some thoughts with us on all of that?
I can in this basic sense. to the extent there are violations of human rights, military force and unrestricted bombing is not much of a solution. I think there are real problems to be faced in international affairs. I am strongly in favor of human rights. I don't like the abuse of populations by anybody. I think there have been several declarations at the United Nations levels, resolutions of the General Assembly, the Genocide Convention, the Human Rights Convention. All of these are declarations as to what these basic rights are, one of which is to stay alive. nobody has undertaken to consider how you enforce it. Are there ways in which this could be done? I think they could at least be explored. As I mentioned before, I think the nuclear proliferation is extremely dangerous for mankind. All we're doing is sitting on it. We keep on saying these lesser countries outside the law ought not have nuclear weapons. We ought to have them because we're reliable people. And we're demonstrating our reliability by bombing the Yugoslavs.
Well, I was just going to say, the thought that the United States has this type of weaponry sitting in its arsenal probably doesn't create a lot of peaceful feelings around the world, because they're seeing what we do when we believe somebody has crossed us.
Well, obviously, we wouldn't use nuclear weapons with respect to small countries, because our ordinary weapons are more than adequate to do the job from our perspective. Our does not include me, but
right.
From the perspective of the government. But temporarily, we are probably the one superpower on Earth, and this has led to delusions of grandeur, I think. And I'm afraid that down the road it's going to lead to a new Cold War, because I think there are large countries with large populations who may be technologically behind today, but they won't be technologically behind forever. This includes the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians. They're going to draw inferences from this, and I think they have drawn inferences from this from whatever literature I've seen. And one or another coalition will arise to confront the Western European coalition. We'll be back to a Cold War in spades, with more nuclear weapons all over the world in the hands of everybody. And for my grandchildren, not me, it makes very little difference to me, I'm old, but for my grandchildren, I tremble at the world of the future.
And I would like to really mention how I liked when you say doesn't include me. We always used in the media and on TV say, oh, we need to bomb, we need to stand for this and that. And I'm always wondering who we, and I'm glad you said it, doesn't include.
It certainly doesn't include me. I didn't think that I was providing much of an endorsement for the administration.
And I think most of our listeners would agree that we are not being asked very much on the issues of foreign policy. And that's why we take opportunity in this community forum called KVMR to bring this kind of conversation, which usually don't get a chance much on mainstream media.
Walter Rockler, thank you for joining us on the program to talk about war crimes, war criminals, war crimes trials, and international law, and certainly sharing your perspective from being one of the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials, and also your expertise as a lawyer in your current life. Thank you for being with us on Community Radio today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us, and have a good day, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this edition of the program. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. If you're interested in copies of this or other Full Logic Reverse programs, you can contact us via email at flr@jps.net or by telephone at area code 530-265-9462. Full Logic Reverse is produced at FLR Studios in Nevada City, California, USA. Our music is by Rick Payne. We hope you'll join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.